And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn where the things we would kind of look at during daytime or maybe see on CNN or Fox and we go, oh, give me a break. At this time of night, you know, we have the time to kind of consider other evidence, other input, other things that may make those things we dismiss in daytime very different at this time of night. Well, we have an amazing show this morning. I've been looking forward to this for so long. We're going to be talking about Star Trek, one of my favorite topics, because 50 years ago, in less than a month, a mutual friend of ours, me and my guest, did something extraordinary, following a whole bunch of extraordinary things in television, and it really changed the world. And I want to talk to Susan tonight about how Gene changed the world and how we can finish the job. Before we get to that, however, I wanted to call your attention to some important news items. As you know, last night we did a half hour with Mark Westwood, who is at KCAA. The firefighters, something like 1,300 firefighters, are battling this amazing fire, this blue-cut fire, which they're describing as they've never seen anything like it. It may be the terrain, it may be the physics, it may, who knows what. But those fire fountains that Mark sent me last night, I think they're posted up on last night's page. Astonishing. I mean, literally tornadoes made of fire, plasma whipping hundreds of feet into the air, just staggering. And, you know, we see things like that on Mars. They're not made of fire, of course, they're made of dust. But to see something that long and skinny on Earth made of you know, crackling chemical, you know, explosions is just absolutely astonishing. A couple of the other items, some of the evacuations have been lifted. People are beginning to return to their homes, thank goodness. The larger news, of course, is around the Rio events. We're going to talk tomorrow night on in some part of the show. We're going to, you know, look back at Rio and the extraordinary contrast, because we have, again, a quintessential example of the good getting better and the bad getting worse. And it's just fascinating. And finally, last but not least, if you look down at number 5 in my items, remember, you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on that. That's our homepage for the show. You look for the Radio with Pictures logo. Click on that. That takes you to tonight's guest page, and you just scroll down, and you'll see my items, and you'll see my guest items. And the last item under mine, number 5, the Smithsonian has set 3 days of a Star Trek 50-year celebration. And apparently they have moved the restored and refurbished original model that Paramount and Gene gave to the Smithsonian from the first season. They've restored that now. It's pristine, original newness. Well, kind of. They've replaced the incandescent bulbs that had actually burned some of the structure inside with LEDs. And the thing looks amazing. And it's sitting in the main hall. When you enter the Air and Space Museum at the Smithsonian, on your right, there will be this huge mural by Robert McCall depicting the landing on the moon. And right in the middle, as you, you know, approach, there's this huge model of the Enterprise at eye level, the original Enterprise just sitting there. I mean, it's when we think of the history of the show and we think of where it's going and where humanity is going, an awful lot of the things that Gene and I and my guest and I talked about are really, if you just look around, they're all coming true. I'm going to talk about two astonishing technological breakthroughs directly connected to Star Trek tonight that this show has funded. You guys have funded two radical space propulsion systems, and I'm going to give you an update when we return. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and when we come back, we're going boldly where no one has gone before.
Space, a final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations. to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Well, as they say, that certainly needs no introduction. God, Bill sounds so young there. We all were so young, wide-eyed and excited, and NASA was doing its thing, and within years of this show appearing, something unprecedented in human consciousness occurred. Humankind landed on the moon. And in the middle of all this, kind of by, I don't know, nodal points, accident, predestination, whatever, a gal named Susan Sackett became the main assistant and chief cook and bottle washer, as my dad used to say when he was in the Navy, to the great bird of the galaxy, all of which will be explained in the next couple of hours. Susan Sackett grew up in Connecticut and Florida and received both her Bachelor of Arts and Masters of Education degrees from the University of Florida in Gainesville in 1964-65. After teaching elementary school in Miami for a couple of years, she moved to Los Angeles, we'll find out why momentarily, where she also taught there for a short time. But her lifelong dream of working in Hollywood persisted. I mean, she was now so close. And she quit her teaching job to work in the entertainment industry. She spent the next 4 years with the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, as a publicity assistant and commercial coordinator. And then in August of 1974, she began an association with one Gene Roddenberry, creator of the television legend Star Trek, serving as his personal executive assistant for over 17 years until his very untimely death in October of 1991. She also served as his production assistant on the first Star Trek film and worked closely with him on the next five Star Trek movies. In addition, she served as production associate during the first five seasons of the television series Star Trek The Next Generation. Susan and her writing partner, Fred Bronson, later sold several stories in a teleplay to the series, including the popular episodes Ménage à Trois and The Game. Susan and Fred have also sold stories to other series, Sliders, and continue to work together as television writing partners. Well, I could read more and more and more, but it's all there on Susan's page here on The Other Side of Midnight, so why don't we just get to her? Susan, welcome to The Other Side.
Hi, thank you, Richard.
You know, what's so amazing to me is you and I, up until we spoke a few days ago, had not talked for decades.
Decades, absolutely.
Literally, and it's like when you picked up the phone, or I guess I left a message, I forget how, but when I heard your voice, it was like I talked to you a couple of days ago.
Yeah, well, we just clicked and knew each other from way back when, and we're still, I've followed your career. I don't know that I have one that you could have followed, but I know what you've been up to, and so I've always thought about you, and there you are. Only you're now in Albuquerque. You do move around.
In Albuquerque, and as of tonight, in 154 other countries. If you go to The Other Side of Midnight, look up on the right-hand side, there's that little spinning globe. We call it the widget. And if you click on it, it takes you to pages with statistics and numbers and cities and all that. We're in 154 countries. I mean, just astonishing. In only about a year, the show's only been on the air a little over a year, and we moved from Arts Network over to this one, and it's going gangbusters. And of course, we're now in this approach to the 50th anniversary of something you and I have been inextricably involved in for so long. When you look back, what kind of a chunk of your life do you think of as the time you spent with Gene creating Star Trek?
Well, I wasn't there when he created Star Trek.
Well, remember, he
Next Generation.
He did something that nobody ever is supposed to do in Hollywood. He did something again, and he did it better than the first time. And it's like...
Some people think so. I do, for one.
I do, of course. And the more I've looked at them, the more I've seen the evolution. I mean, it's like you watch these things, and there are so many nuggets. You know, Robin says, how can you watch that so many times? It's because every time... there's something new. There's something that an association I didn't connect, be it a directorial thing or a script thing or just watching this thing unfold that captivates so many people now. I mean, at one point, I don't know whether he ever said this to you, but he told me, he said, Dick, it used to be said that the British Empire had the sun never set on it. He said, I can say now that Star Trek never has the sun set on it, meaning it's somewhere around the Earth. It's playing in reruns 24/7 all over this world.
Yeah, I guess that's true, and in its various incarnations, especially the original and Next Generation, and the films are out there now with Netflix and all the various online ways of watching things, Hulu and whatnot. It's out there forever, I guess.
So how does it feel, and I want you to be very honest on this, how does it feel to be associated with something that has literally changed history?
It was partly what I did for my work. I mean, working with Gene, and partly being involved with Star Trek. You know, when I first met him and I was applying for the position that he had open, which was secretary. He had a secretary when he was at Warner Brothers between Star Treks. He had he did a few movies and television pilots. And the secretary that he brought from the studio wanted to go back to the studio, and Gene was working out of his house. And so I went up for the interview at his house, and he said,
was that house up above Sunset where you would climb up that windy road?
Yeah. It was on Leander Place in Bel Air, Beverly Hills. And, I went in for the interview and I handed him my resume, and he stuck it in the desk drawer and never, ever read it, ever. we did what we're doing now. We had a conversation, and he said to me, now, are you familiar with Star Trek? And, I'm salivating and I'm trying not to show.
This is in August, what, of 74, right?
It was his birthday, August 19th, 1974.
Wow.
Same as today. And I said,
now that's eerie. That's really, hang on a second. Okay. I make note of synchronicities.
Oh, absolutely.
When you and I planned to do this, I did not remember that the day was his birthday, and you didn't tell me, and we just plotted it for when you'd be available. And again, here we are on Gene's. How old would Gene be if he was still with us?
Today would be his 95th birthday.
My.
I know. It's hard to picture him as a 95-year-old, but...
it's like kind of like trying to imagine John Kennedy is in his 90s.
An old person,
yeah.
Right. Or John Lennon.
I think Gene, if he was still around, would be so involved in what's going on and the cutting-edge things that I'm going to talk about a couple things tonight. And I so miss him not being able to talk to him about, see, you said this was going to go on, and you said that, and... here we are. I mean, it's just astonishing that we're going to celebrate something amazing that he's created. I'm not using hyperbole when I say Star Trek changed civilization.
And a lot of the things that were predicted by Star Trek have come to pass technically. The ubiquitousness of computers and just all the things that are used in everyday life, like cell phones, and the communicator was basically a cell phone.
Mm. I think Motorola, the engineers actually did it. They modeled their flip phone after the communicator.
Yeah, they did, and I just saw that recently too. I'm not sure where I read that, but I
think Shatner has had a couple of specials where he goes through, without me, Star Trek and the inventions wouldn't exist and all that. But it's actually very good information.
I don't know if it would exist without Shatner. I don't think he came up with those things.
But Bill, how did Gene cast? I mean, you were there 10 years after the original. You saw him do something even more amazing. I watched him do it, which is I told him flatly that lunch I came down that day, I said, it's not going to work. You can't. There can only be one 2001. That was our big kind of, Arthur Clarke conversation. And he went and proved us wrong. He proved me wrong. Because I think Next Generation has such depth and such nuance that you couldn't do 10 years earlier. So how did he approach doing it again?
Because it was not going to be on a network, for one thing. And so he didn't have to answer to censors.
Explain that to people who, of course, now we live in a world of a million networks. So.
Right. Well, when Star Trek was first created, there were three major networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC. And... if you were going to be on television with a weekly show, you were on one of those three networks. And there was a censor, a person who would sit there with a pencil and a pen and a script, and they would go through it line by line.
Didn't Johnny Carson call her Miss Goodbody?
I have no idea.
Yeah, he kept talking about Miss Goodbody. And for those of us who didn't know, no, there was no Miss Goodbody who was the censor. But him saying that immediately gave you the impression of, you know, Mary Poppins with the glasses and the sharp pencil. And
right. It was. Well, I'm not sure that's what they look like. But basically, I mean, he said that they would come around and measure the ladies' skirts to make sure they weren't too short and things like that. And then they would have dialogue. If you were to say, "Oh my God," the censor would write, "Be sure they say that reverently." They crazy stuff, you know, and don't show too much boob and things like that. And so,
Didn't they have a real problem? Or didn't Jeans have the problem because he put all his women in miniskirts at a time when miniskirts in prime time were not there, and it was a serious issue for Miss Goodbody.
And that was why they actually did. I mean, I wasn't there, but Jean told me they actually would take a ruler and measure to see how short. And still, he got away with things. And he got away with philosophy. And you couldn't at the time. It was the Vietnam War, and you couldn't criticize outright. So he would put it on a far off planet somewhere and say that, you know, we had no right to interfere with this planet. And what he was really saying was, we shouldn't be interfering with other countries on our planet and their way of life.
So that was the relevance of the Prime Directive.
Right, exactly. And he was able to get away with it by putting it on, you know, a far off planet with purple people or whatever. Then when the Next Generation was created, he didn't have those constraints because it was in what is known as syndication.
Okay.
Which is not the same as a network. Syndication meant that private or independent television stations could air this show, and there were no restraints. I mean, there were still, you know, language restraints. You couldn't say the F word and, you know, certain things.
Right.
But there were still there was a lot more leeway with
well, there things. Weren't this whole phalanx of, as he used to call them, the suits.
Yeah.
From upstairs.
Exactly.
I mean, when I look back, it's astonishing how much he got done in the original series that is really at the edge of the edge of the edge. I mean, look at that kiss between Nichelle and Shatner. I mean, that caused such ripples and such firestorms in the South.
They didn't air it on in some stations in Alabama, I think, refused to air the episode because there was a black woman and a white man kissing. That was just something they would never do and never show. And
was the Diane Carroll show on at the same time? Because I seem to remember she had a major NBC show, but she didn't have interracial kissing, I guess.
I don't think so. But, yeah, I remember because I was teaching school in Miami at that time. I hadn't moved out to L.A. yet, and I was actually teaching in the inner city in school with mostly African-American children. And, it was great. I loved it. And, you know, I felt so appreciated and just happy to be able to be there and do my thing. And I remember the principal coming in the next day and just glowing because they're not used to seeing black families acting normally on TV. Most of the time they were playing maids and servants. And here was a woman who was, I believe she was a nurse. And so they were just overwhelmed.
There it was, prime time, the Diane Carroll show. But what Nichelle and Bill did was they crossed that barrier. It was like, remember when we grew up, we always watched, you know, Ozzie and Harriet in their two beds?
Right, right.
I kept wondering, why don't they sleep together? I mean, you know.
That was TV censors.
That was
They were not. And that was a holdover from movie days when they had the Hayes office. And they were, and then carried into the TV shows where they had to either, they had to have one foot on the floor, I think, if they did have a double bed. One foot always had to be on the floor. And you know, Desi and Lucy and I Love Lucy, if you ever saw them and they were talking, they had twin beds. And, I mean, it was just ridiculous.
But. Yeah. So, all right. So the backstory of how Gene got around this stuff. Did you guys in The Next Generation, you say because it was at UPN, and UPN was the United...
It was going to be the Paramount Network, but it did not air on the Paramount. Paramount was going to start the fourth network, which eventually became the Fox Network. But Paramount was you know, at the fore trying to do that. And Star Trek The Next Generation was going to be the flagship program for that network, but that never happened, and it went into syndication. I believe Paramount did eventually have the UPN, and I think Star Trek was on it, but it became more independent rather than a network that, at least Star Trek The Next Generation, was syndicated, which means it could have been on, you know, Channel 11 or Channel 5 or any Channel 3, any independent station that wanted to pick it up. And there wasn't a lot of cable in those days either. We're talking the late 80s, 1980s. Cable was just starting to come into its own. I think that's another reason why it would have been syndicated rather than on, say, TBN or something.
Yeah, they bicycled the tape around, and you bought the tape, and you put the tape on at the right time, and the show played, and it had its own commercials. And so that really, I mean, it was the syndication of Star Trek that freed it to really look at interesting things.
Actually, because I'm so involved in humanism, I sometimes go around the country, and I've been in many cities, and I do a little slide talk called Humanism in Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry was a humanist, and he got me interested in humanism. And
now you got to tell people where Gene got it from.
Well, Isaac Asimov was a good friend of his, and he was the honorary president of the American Humanist Association. Actually, I think he was the president, not so much honorary. And
this is Isaac now.
Isaac Asimov, right? And so he sent Gene a copy of his book called Asimov's Guide to the Bible.
Ah.
And Gene read it, and he said, "You got to read this book. It's fascinating." And he takes apart a lot of the stories and talks about the backstories and where they came from in further mythology, further back and into the Babylonians and all this stuff. And he goes right through it, and it's just fascinating stuff. And so Gene decided that he was going to explore humanism a little bit more. Well, we used to sit and talk, you know, quite a bit. We'd have lunch or dinner and sit and chat, and discovered that this was the way I felt too. And so I got really involved in humanism. And in The Next Generation, now there were some hints at this in the first series, the original series, as far as, you know, his humanist philosophy of treating everyone fairly and exploring and the rights of people and the rights of aliens, really. And, you know, don't shoot the alien because you're afraid of them. Get to talk with them and know them and kindness to one another and things like that. And then,
I mean, the most vivid example of that was the Horda. Mm-hmm. Remember the Horda, you know, with McCoy and his trowel and his cement and this mysterious monster that's eating all these miners. And I mean, for 20th century Americans and the Vietnam thing going on and all that, to see that in their living rooms was different. It was so different.
And it was an episode that really appreciated other life and other life forms, and they discovered that it was a mother who was protecting her eggs. And I love the line that Dr. McCoy had in that, "I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer." But anyway, so with The Next Generation, he was able to go even farther. And there's a wonderful example of an episode. There are a couple of good ones. One is I think it's the same one, Who Watches the Watchers. And it's about a group of proto-Vulcans that are being observed by people from Starfleet. And one of them is injured, and then they are accidentally discovered.
Oh, that was the whole God thing, yes.
Right, exactly. By the people on the planet who think that they are gods from space.
The great Picard will be unhappy if we don't sacrifice, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And that episode, you know, he says, you know, this is so primitive, you shouldn't be worshiping me, and you know, you've got to find your own way, and I can't do these things for you. And I mean, it really talks about several things, non-interference. And Picard has this great speech about how we gave up these superstitions many, many years ago. And this is humanism. this is secular humanism, and this is sort of what I'm involved in, and Gene got me interested in it because that was the way he was, too.
I'll tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We have to take a break. I want to announce that this show and all our other shows will be available, of course, on Club 19.5. You just go to the main page, the home page, click on the 19.5 subscribe link, and, you know, $5 a month. Come on, that's Starbucks. But because we're in 154 countries tonight, a lot of people are sleeping when we're on. Imagine that. Some people even here are sleeping when we're on. So if you join the club, Club 19.5, you get the images, you get the conversation, and the most important, you get time. Time in a bottle. It's your time to spend your way. You can spend it any way you want. Oh, by the way, if you want to join this conversation, we also have a Facebook page, The Other Side of Midnight Facebook. Go over there, find some folks, talk to them. Susan and I are going to continue our conversation over here, and you might like to join us. In fact, toward the end of the show, we'll open the lines, and you can ask Susan some questions if you want. If you want to write down the numbers, 505-796-8802, or on Skype, Enterprise Mission, or The Other Side of Midnight. You are on The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning, Susan Sackett. Very old and dear friend. Well, she's not that old, but she's very dear.
And Thanks a lot.
We have things we're going to talk about momentarily. We shall return. We are back, and let me see where we are back to. David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust. Let's listen.
Jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far.
And we are back with Sounds and Echoes and Frequencies. You know, doing this when you're scattered all over the world, sometimes stray signals creep in. Look, there's an awful lot of people that they only know about Gene Roddenberry as kind of this guy that created this thing. What kind of a person was Gene? I mean, you worked with him for 17 Egyptological resurrection years. That number in the Egyptian pantheon has a great deal of meaning. So what was the guy behind the camera, the guy behind the set, the guy behind the desk?
Well, you know, I've it's hard to just say it very briefly.
We don't have to be brief. We have hours.
Well, what I'm trying to say is I really go into depth about our personal relationship in the book. You can see the
Let's start by talking about the book, okay?
Well, the book is called Inside Trek, which I can get away with because if I said Star Trek, I'd have to pay somebody a royalty or something. I don't know. My Secret Life with Star Trek Creator. It's an adjective. That's okay.
Okay.
Gene Roddenberry. So, yes, I
well,
do
wait.
About,
you can't copyright titles. Star Trek.
The name Star Trek is trademarked.
Yeah, well, it depends on how you space it. Anyway, so you said Inside Trek. Everybody knows what you mean, so.
It's okay. And it's available as an ebook. And I have a website called InsideTrek.com. And people can buy my hard copy that I'll sign if they're interested. But the book is basically about my personal relationship with Gene, which was extremely personal and intimate over the course of about 16 years, I would say, until his death. And I do go into detail in it. If anybody is really interested, they can...
Well, you got 154 countries listening.
I know.
Somebody's interested, all right?
I hope so. I mean, they're really interested. You know, I don't want to go into the gory details on the radio. It's something, it's easier to write about than it is to speak about. I don't know if I can...
Well, the thing I... All right, let me start with my impressions. I called up Gene because Fred Pohl, who was a big, big, big name in sci-fi, in the original science fiction... Fred Pohl came to Springfield, Massachusetts, and he had a speaking gig up, I think, at Amherst, which was north of us. And I, at that time, had my fledgling radio show, and I got him on as a guest. And then I volunteered to drive him from the radio station up to his speaking gig at the university. And on the way up, he casually mentioned to me that Star Trek was going to be canceled. Mm. And I said, what? So I said, what can we, you know, I had a radio show, right? When you have your first radio show, you think you can move the world, right? Archimedes, levers, that kind of thing. What can we do to change this? Because to me, Star Trek was amazing for its time and place. I mean, watching that first episode, the first one that aired in September, the one about Dr.
Man-Trap.
It was the Salt Monster episode.
Yeah, the episode was called The Man-Trap.
Yes. And yeah. it was so different. It was so right on, including the opening scene with the Enterprise kind of turning around the planet. Can you believe that Gene apologized to me on top of Kit Peake for that opening montage of the Enterprise? He said it wasn't what he wanted. It was the only thing he could get out of the illustrators and the animation people. And I said, Gene, it grabbed everybody. It was perfect. He was a perfectionist. He never was satisfied.
No, he wasn't. He always thought it could be done better. And he was a rewriter. If he was writing a script, he would rewrite the first 20 pages and not move on until that was perfect. And I'd want to know how it turned out. And he'd be busy with those first 20 pages trying to perfect them.
So Paul is telling me this thing is going to be canceled, this amazing miracle that landed on NBC in prime time. So I picked up the phone. I was at the museum. I had a free telephone. You know, give me a phone. Give me a museum supported by a city. And in those days, long-distance calls were expensive. So I picked up the phone from the museum, and I called Hollywood. I literally went through the directory, and there was a Gene Roddenberry listed, and I dialed his number,
yep.
And he answered.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, my God.
Yeah. He said that he kept his number in the phone book in case any of his old Army buddies showed up in town and they wanted to get in touch with him. So he was listed.
Well, that was the beginning, of course, totally changed my life, and I was able to slip certain things into the show, you know, like technical stuff. But the thing that really struck me was at that first conversation, he said, I'm sitting on the floor here in my basement, and he said, I'm working on an idic. And I said, you're working on a what? He said, an idic. He said, I'm a goldsmith. I'm a silversmith. Robin, you know, does all this stuff now, so I see how it actually happens. Yeah. He was creating the jewel that Spock would wear in certain ceremonies commemorating infinite diversity in infinite combination. The idea that the human race celebrates itself and other alien entities. And he was creating something to be shown on the show, and he was physically, as the executive producer, doing it himself. And I was so blown away, because that was the hands. That's why Star Trek was so unique and will ever be unique, because Gene was unique.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. And getting back to the gory details, your producer loves gory, she said. It was an intimate relationship, a romance, you could call it. I don't want to... Yeah, it's hard to talk about this live and, you know, on the radio. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that I'm used to talking about. So that's why I wrote about it, because it's so much easier. But he was, we had a meeting of the minds. We were, and I'm not
you were
trying
soulmates.
To,
come on, you were soulmates.
I'm not trying. Yeah, well, yeah, maybe.
Why is
I'm
that? Well, I mean, obviously,
trying to say that I'm intelligent, but you know, I'm not the kind of person to brag. But we did have a mental relationship where he bounced ideas off of me. I listened. I would comment. I mean, at first I was terrified. You know, who am I to talk to the great and powerful Roddenberry?
How did he get the nickname Great Bird of the Galaxy?
Oh, I think that was something that came out of the original series. I'm not sure. May the Great Bird of the Galaxy land on your planet or something. I'm not sure where that came from, but I think it was just a joke. I've lost my train of thought. Sorry.
Well, we're talking about the kind of guy Gene was. You were intimate. You were an item.
We were.
You guys obviously shared everything. And so you're in a unique position to tell people who don't know who this person was. They only heard the name. It's a very unusual name. Roddenberry is not like any other name you're going to run into in television or film or whatever. But the guy who created this, which people lose themselves in again and again and again, and imagine a future that works. And we're certainly living in a future now that's not working. So Gene imagined there was a way we could get from here to there. And that show was a vehicle for showing people how to get from here to there. So, again, who was the guy behind it? Because he had to be a pretty special guy. I mean, as a friend, I knew he was special. And I had a relationship by phone 3,000 miles away most of the time.
I would, you know, put him in the category of a Renaissance man. I mean, as you said, he was doing jewelry. He was extremely literate. He read constantly. He could discuss philosophy. He could discuss politics. He was into everything. He had a thirst for knowledge, and he just was constantly learning. And he was interested in artificial intelligence. He was a friend of Marvin Minsky from MIT. I don't know if you remember him.
Of course.
He passed away recently. But
Marvin shared one of my early ship cruises on the QE2. Marvin and I had a wonderful relationship, and I did not know he was that good friends with Gene, because I keep meeting people who, you know, I mean, Gene was kind of like this generalist nexus where everybody who had interesting ideas would just bounce them off of him, and they would wind up, some of them, in Star Trek.
And he collected people. If somebody was an interesting person like yourself or or Marvin Minsky or, if I can't off the top of my head think of people that...
Well, there was an incredible dinner that he and Arthur Clarke and I had in an Indian restaurant at the foot of Central Park, right next to the executive, whatever that big hotel is. Hmm. And we had an incredible conversation that night. And, you know, you're right. He collected people, but he collected the creme de la creme de la creme. It's like, remember when John Kennedy said, when he had the whole bunch of Nobel laureates, you know, for dinner, and he said there hasn't been this much intelligence in this room since Thomas Jefferson dined alone.
Alone, right. I love that line.
That was Gene. Gene dining alone had more vision than most of the people that you and I have run into. And that's why Star Trek was so magical, still is, because it was so much more than just a sci-fi, you know, TV show.
No, he had something to say. I mean, he believed in the future of humanity. He would say that it's not all over. The human adventure is just beginning, and we're a very primitive species. We're in our infancy, but we're growing. We're going to grow up one of these days. And the optimism of Star Trek in the 23rd and 24th century was what he said and what the fans seemed to think was what kept it going. People want to see an optimistic future. They don't want to think that it's going to be all wars.
Well, it's not that they want to see it. They want to live in it. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I talked to back during the heyday when Star Trek was on, it was live and all that. People would not, they didn't think of it as just a TV show. They saw it as a roadmap, Susan. They saw it as a way to get from where we are to where we want to be. You know, where people do care about each other, where you had, I mean, look at the bridge crew of the original series. It covered everybody.
Yeah.
Where did he get the idea for Star Trek? Let's go back to the very, very beginning.
He was a TV writer, and he
worked on Have Gun Would Travel, I think.
But when he was a child, he had asthma and a lot of other things, and so he couldn't go out and play in the sunshine. He would talk about this in his lectures. He was allergic to sunshine. I mean, he had all these allergies and things, and so he had to stay indoors and read. And he read a lot of the pulp fiction that was out in those days when he was a child, the space adventures and whatnot. And he'd always had a fondness for that. But he wrote other things. And he decided to create this show, and he was a big fan of the Horatio Hornblower books.
The British Admiral.
Yeah, who was the guy that wrote those? Forrester or something like that. Anyway, E.M. Forrester, or do I have the wrong writer?
I think you have the wrong writer, yeah.
I have the wrong writer. But anyway, whoever did the Horatio Hornblower books. And when he created the crew, he sort of lived through Captain Kirk as the the kind of he had been a Pan Am pilot, so he had experience with flying, and so this was flying in a spaceship.
Mm.
And he lived vicariously, I think.
Well, he had such an amazing. I mean, it was a Pan Am pilot. He was a police officer there in L.A.
Yeah, he'd had that experience too. That was a family tradition. His brother was a police officer. His father was a police officer. I think his father was in the cavalry in Texas, where Gene was born. But so you know, he'd had all. You're always a product of all of your experiences, anyway. And so he created Kirk to be the brave, bold captain who always gets the girl, and you know, it was kind of a
you were right. M just sent me a note. Horatio Hornblower is a fictional Napoleonic Wars era Royal Navy officer, British, of course, who is the protagonist of a series of novels by C.S. Forster.
F-O-R-E-S. I think I said E.M. Forrester, because I think there's also an E.M.
there, and he writes science fiction, yeah.
Yeah, or
C.S. Forster, F-O-R-E-S-T-E-R. Someone the other day, I think it was Vic Mignogna, he is so against the reboot, the J.J. Adams, you know, alternate universe thing.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get him to see that if Gene was still with us, Gene would so have embraced, this is my opinion, what Adams is trying to do, because that's back to Idik, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. What happens in a timeline that is not this one, but one adjacent? And to me, you know, Vic's point was, well, you wouldn't have a brat basically grow up, you know, accelerated through Starfleet and wind up commanding the Enterprise. And I said, did you ever read any of the Horatio Hornblower shows? Because that's who Hornblower was. He was a brat, a brash brat who basically created his own law. And that's what Gene wrote. You know, it was kind of like he modeled Starfleet after a 19th century British empire where it took a while, even at Warp 9, to get places. So you had a starship isolated from central, from Earth, where a captain had to basically make his own law, his own decisions, his own judgments. He was on his own.
And that was something that Gene had to do that too in his role in, you know, being a pilot and whatever, and a World War II veteran as well.
Well, didn't he crash at one point and save his whole crew?
Not the whole crew, but he did. Some people did die. He crashed in the desert, I think, in Syria back in the late 1940s, when he was a Pan Am captain. And I don't think he was actually in charge on that flight. I think he was deadheading, and the plane crashed in the desert, and he went with a couple of the crew and brought help for the people that were, you know, still able to most of them survived.
Did you ever see that movie with Jimmy Stewart, The Phoenix?
No.
Oh, it's about a plane crashing and they cut it up and they fly it out. Sounds very, when I read Gene's story, I thought, I wonder if he talked to the guy who wrote that book. Anyway, so back to the original series. Where did he conceive of Spock? I mean, Spock, that whole triumvirate, Spock and McCoy and Kirk, it's almost like, I saw someone the other day who said they were each a fractional part of a whole being.
Right, I was going to say that. Kirk was the daring doer. He was the brave one, and Spock was the rational part of a mind. It could be like a trifold mind, a trinity, if you want. And McCoy was the was the one who would say, no, you can't do that because that's not nice and that's not right. And, you know, and so together they were able to be, I don't know, it was more than a friendship. It was more like a one mind, like a hive mind almost.
It was magical. It snared everybody. It's why Star Trek worked. I mean, how important, I'm going to have you flip now in your production role, how important is casting? How many times do we just have magic happen, but it isn't by design? It's just because, again, synchronicity, it's supposed to happen?
Well, some of these people Gene had worked with before. He did a show called The Lieutenant, which he created.
Oh, yeah, the Marine
and
show.
And he had a lot of the people that were in the cast. He used them again in Star Trek. And I think Nichelle was in it. I think Majel was in it. I'm not sure about the captain originally was not Shatner. The captain was going to be Jeffrey Hunter.
Right.
And he was in the original pilot of The Cage. And he got the go-ahead finally after a while. It was Captain Pike. And then when the show was finally picked up,
This is by NBC.
I'm sorry. Yeah, by NBC. Jeffrey Hunter's wife talked him out of it.
Oh, what?
You don't want to do television. It's not going to go anywhere. You're a movie star. What are you doing? You know, he had played Jesus or something, and that was his big role.
Right.
And he said, you don't want to do that. So he had to recast, and I guess Shatner had done – he had done some Twilight Zones, and he had done a lot of things.
He did that Twilight Zone, the weird thing at 20,000 feet with the beast on the wing, and he's the only one who can see it and all that.
Right. He did that one. He did another one where the little thing at the table keeps spitting out messages about it's like it's alive. They're sitting in a cafe. I don't remember the
name. I don't think I saw that one. My God, there's a Twilight Zone I haven't seen?
I know. No, they're in a cafe, and he's there with his wife, and you know, it says, put 5 cents in here, and I'll give you a message. And it keeps spitting out these messages, and he becomes addicted to it. And I can't remember how it ends.
Oh, I do. I remember the freneticism, because Bill was very, very good at freneticism, you know.
Yeah. And, he was. That's his thing. So I guess maybe he had seen him in some things. And it was funny because William Shatner, Bill Shatner, and Leonard Nimoy had both appeared on The Man from U.N.C.L.E., but they had – I'm not sure if they were in the same episode together or – and they really didn't know each other. And then they ended up in Star Trek together. So
and then they ended up with this very long, very complicated. I mean, all of the cast of Star Trek have had these long, complicated relationships with each other.
Yeah, and they become friends. I mean, I think Bill and Leonard were very good friends. The casting of The Next Generation, because that was from scratch. The man who played, Captain Picard, Patrick Stewart, Gene didn't want him right away.
Really?
Yeah, he thought he was...
Oh, my God, and I thought he was so brilliant, because the more I look back at Stewart, it's such a compliment to Bill and such a different look at a captain and the individuality of decisions and the loneliness of command. And in other words, he was able to really flesh out the captain when he finally got Picard, but he didn't want Stewart. Who did he want?
I don't know that he had anybody specifically in mind, but when he had a couple of people that had come in to play, to read, but I can't remember. You know, we're talking about 1987 now, so it's almost 30 years ago. But he said, I don't want this bald guy for my captain. And I think it was Robert Justman, who had worked on the original series, who spotted him in a play at UCLA that he was in, and he thought, gee, this guy'd be good for captain. So he called him in to read, and that was when Gene went, until he heard him and saw him, and then he realized how good he was.
And then he saw a whole other dimension.
Oh, yeah, no, he was a great Shakespearean actor, and he's got such a magnificent voice.
Well, the thing that made Patrick so interesting was he took the role totally seriously. You never got a hint of tongue-in-cheek in other words, he became that individual and he sold it to everybody.
Yeah, no, he played it straight. He was very good at it. And some of the other people that were, for example, the one that Denise Crosby played, Tasha Yar, and Marina Sirtis played Troy, Deanna Troi, and I'll tell you about the Deanna part in a minute. But originally, they read for the opposite roles, and they were going to be playing.
Well, Denise was going to be the counselor, and Troi was going to be
Marina. Was going to be the navigator or whatever she was. I don't know what Tasha Yar.
She was tactical officer.
Okay,
she was weapons and combat and all that.
Yeah, so. Anyway, so they were, cast, but they read for different roles. And then there were a number of people that came in for the part that Jonathan Frakes ended up getting, which is Commander Riker. And I remember that he was called back. And call back usually means, you know, you're really being considered. And mm-hmm. he came back. And I remember him sitting in my office, which was the outer office to Gene's office. And the door would be closed. And he's sitting there talking to me. And he goes, do you think I'm going to get it? I'm going to get it. So, yeah, he got the role. By the way, the episode that I wrote is not Ménage à Trois. It's Ménage à Troy. It's a pun. Deanna Troy. And interestingly, and the Wesley Crusher character kept changing when it was being created. First, it was Leslie Crusher. It was going to be a woman or a girl, a young girl. And somehow that got talked out of, I guess they were afraid that there'd be too many women on the bridge. I'm not sure. And so it became Wesley Crusher. Now, Wesley is Gene's middle name. Eugene Wesley Roddenberry.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So that's where that name came from. Deanna Troy. Deanna is my middle name. Susan Deanna Sackett.
Oh, so how interesting. So you are immortalized. And it's like when I was at CBS with Cronkite, we had a guy in the art department. He would write his name in the clouds of the spinning earth that would be behind Cronkite during the moon coverage. Mm. And his name was Tom Barger. And he took me down one day and he showed me his name. And when we saw it, after you saw it, you always saw it. But if you didn't know it was there, it was such an interesting example of people don't see things unless it's pointed out to them a lot of times.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So this immortalization, so you're immortalized in Star Trek in Deanna's name. Well, it's cool to know.
Yeah, yeah. I was happy when he did that. The other thing that I'm proud of that I contributed with, two things. One was, and I noticed you said at the beginning of the show, and now we're going to go where no one has gone before. Gene was going to just put in no man as he did in the original series, you know, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Right.
And I said, you know, this is the 80s. You can't just say man anymore. You have to say where no one has gone before and to make it, you know, more ecumenical, more diverse or whatever.
Well, in keeping with his philosophy, which is that people become more and more equal as we get over this primitive part.
And you know, he was a product of his times, too, though, and he didn't quite see that. I mean,
he really
didn't? Generation. No, he didn't.
Oh, that's...
I had to point that out.
I mean, did you have a fight, or was it...
No, well, you know, a discussion.
A discussion.
We didn't put on boxing gloves. And
Okay. Well, anyway, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Actually, top of the hour. I keep looking at the wrong clock. We've got a 30-second station break. They play the NBC tones, so we all feel very, very... at home, and we shall return. My guest this morning, Susan Sackett, and we're discussing one of my favorite topics, Star Trek, and one of my favorite people. Well, my two favorite people, Gene and Susan. And we shall return. And we are back. We are back with my guest of the morning, Susan Sackett. Okay, we got a million questions. Everybody wants to know stuff. I'm trying to do this kind of logically. And I completely lost my train of thought because it's like, this is like a walk down memory lane. I mean, matching the things that you know. I didn't know anything about these names. I mean, all these little codes hidden in the series. So let me just ask you one. Someone wrote in, why was Troy's costume so low cut? And this obviously has a very heavy reason, right?
Oh, yeah. It's because of the sexist men that were producing the show. They said, let's have her have a, you know, cut it lower. We can do that now. We're not on NBC anymore.
Oh, my God.
We're syndicated. We can do anything we want.
So how did the syndication work? I know what Gene imagined would happen, but I think it exceeded his expectations.
Paramount sells it to a bunch of independent stations, and that's syndication. and you can pretty much get away with whatever you want to get away with. There's no censor. There's nobody telling you, you know, this can only be so low cut or whatever. But, you know, we also wanted it to be sort of PG-13, I guess, if you were using movie language, so that we would have a wider audience, obviously. It wasn't just geared towards prepubescent boys or whatever. You know, so there was something for everybody. The first year, the men wore on the bridge, on the ship, wore something called a skort.
A what?
Which, a skort, S-C-O-R-T or S-K-O-R-T, I guess. It was kind of, if you go back to watch an episode from the very first season of Next Generation, the men are wearing what looked like the same dresses that the women were wearing. It was supposed to be unisex, I imagine, and the idea was to just get away from tradition, I think, and just have fun with it. But you'll notice the men wearing, and that went out after the first season. I don't think it was a big hit.
When did Riker's beard come in?
I think it was the second season. Jonathan grew a beard over the summer and decided to keep it, and they decided to just let him keep it. It was, you know, just something he did. It was unusual back in the late 80s. I don't think beards were as popular as they are now.
I've had mine forever, but apparently...
Well, not forever.
Well, almost forever. Anyway, let's talk about Data and Spock. In the first series, Gene did something remarkable. He introduced a half-alien, half-human, who became so iconic that it's now part of the culture. It's like Kleenex. You think of Spock as a real individual that has kind of introduced himself to the human species. When it came to the Next Generation, how did Data come to be?
Well, something that Gene had always toyed with was the idea of what is a human? What makes us human? What are we? Are we machines? Are we living machines? Can there be such a thing as a living machine? Would it have life? He even played with a little of that in the original series. Then he did something called the Questor tapes.
You don't mean the Nomad episode?
No, it was one where they had several where people were in artificial bodies, or they switched bodies, or I don't know.
Oh yeah, I remember. But yeah, they visited several. A planet, and it was like the beings were a mile down, and they had to be brought up and integrated into human bodies while their robotic bodies were being created. And interesting, he toyed with so many things. Okay, hold it there. We're at 5 after. Little break here. My guest this morning, Susan Sackett, and we're warping down memory lane. Can I mix those metaphors? Of course, it's my show. We shall return. So long. For once unafraid, I can go where life leads me. Mamas and papas. You know, it's so interesting. I had someone call me the other day, apropos. Let's kind of keep that in the background. And they claim, like with a whole bunch of other things in this so-called Mandela effect, they claim that the lyrics from this song, from the Mamas and Papas, have been changed. And I... Hang on. He knows I'm gonna stay. Anyway, people are reporting things are different, and in that song, the lyrics, according to some people, have changed. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, 505-796-8802, or on Skype, the Enterprise mission or the other side of midnight. Okay, where should we pick up? Data. We were talking about Data.
Right. I was going to say that Gene, as I was saying, was always interested in what is human and what is a machine and what is the difference and what is consciousness and can you put your consciousness somewhere else? And all of these things fascinated him. And when he created Data, Data was this android character. And it was very similar to Questor, who even his name is obvious. He was on a quest. But he did a pilot for with Universal Studios before Star Trek came back called the Questor Tapes. And Questor was an android who was in search of his creator. And Gene was always doing things like that, trying to find the creator. It ended up being a theme in the first Star Trek movie, too. V'ger was looking for her.
Which was a very ill-disguised adaptation of the infamous Nomad episode.
A little bit.
More than a little bit.
Okay. I won't argue with you, but anyway. So that was kind of how the Data character came about. He could explore what is human and what is it like to be human. And instead of being Spock, who did not want to be human, he wanted to embrace his Vulcan half, Data was just the opposite. Excuse me.
He was Pinocchio.
He wanted to be human, right.
He was Pinocchio. He wanted to be
a little boy. Exactly.
Well, his evolution, I mean, the writing of Data as the series, if you look at the whole series, it's such a perfect evolution of Data's quest. It really is. It's as interesting as Spock's. And again, he did it a decade later. That is what amazed me, because to be able to reprise something and then make it better than your first effort, that really is so rare in any kind of media, certainly in television.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, he had quite a growth of the character from when he first, the character kind of evolved and, you know, wasn't the same towards the end of the series as he was at the beginning. I mean, he ended up having a cat and
Spot. Yes.
Spot, the cat.
Well, Coco, what is it? Coco has a
daughter.
Cat.
Coco.
Yeah. The gorilla.
Oh, Coco the gorilla.
Yeah, famous talking gorilla.
What character was Coco?
There is more to life, Susan, than Star Trek.
Oh, no.
Do you feel that your life was kind of forever turned by those 17 years?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. That was a major part of my life. I mean, it was a job. I worked. I got a paycheck. It wasn't just...
Well,
oh,
it was more than a job. It was
But it was great because I got paid to do what I was having fun doing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and okay, so how did you get into the writing? How did you wind up actually writing for the series?
I had always written. I mean, not necessarily for TV, but it's something I'd started doing when I was in college. I like to write. And then whatever I'm doing, I always feel that, you know, whoever I'm working with, I can do that job too. And so when I worked at NBC in publicity, I took a course in UCLA and how to write press releases in the end. So you know, then I suddenly decided, oh, I must be a publicist. But I wasn't. But you know, I learned the basics of writing and I just, you know, had a few ideas. And then my friend Fred Bronson, whom I met when I was working at NBC, and he was a publicist. And so we just put our heads. So he was a big Star Trek fan, and that was sort of how we became friendly. And we put our heads together and came up with some ideas and sold them. And I just got started writing books because there were a whole pile of letters, fan letters that were coming in that were just totally being ignored.
Really?
And they were funny and they were interesting. And I thought, gee, this would make an interesting book. And I pitched it to Ballantine Books at the time, which had the Star Trek license, and that was my first book. Letters to Star Trek, and then I, you know, just one thing led to another, and I was actually tapped to do a few of the books that I hadn't even planned on doing, like the making of Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yeah, let's stop for a second and go back to letters, because, again, in those days, for everybody who's listening, in all those 154 countries, we didn't have social media, we didn't have iPhones, we didn't have smart, you know, we just had basically three networks on television, mostly right. in black and white. We had phones. We had letters. So people, when they saw something they liked, they would write letters. And those letters were priceless. Talk about the impact you got from the letters in terms of how the show was actually being received.
Well, there were, you know, they ran the gamut of everything from funny to very, very serious and you know, from professional people and people that were, one woman, I recall that she said that her child had been ill or something and hadn't spoken in a long time and suddenly saw Star Trek on TV and began to speak and just, you know, heartwarming stories and things like that. People that were inspired to go into science because of Star Trek. They saw the show and they thought, yeah, I might go into the space program. And it's been a long while since I've reviewed this book. I mean, it was
I know
1970.
I have to go back and look at what I read in mine.
I know it's hard to go back.
But the thing about the audience reaction was, I mean, television stars and television shows get a lot of letters. They get fans. But right. there was something different about the Star Trek fans. It was like they themselves were the crossover between this imaginary world, this future, and they said, I want it now. I want that what I'm seeing, I want it now. I want a world that works. I want a world where people get along, where we don't kill each other, and we think before we shoot. And that, in other words, Gene's model, Gene's vision, in those letters coming back, showed he was connecting in a way that no television show had ever connected before.
I think so. I think it was, well, as you said, there was the letter writing campaign to save the show. I mean, how many other shows were ever saved by a letter writing campaign up until that time? People took it to heart. I took it to heart. I wrote a letter, and I was a fan. I was living in Miami, and I wrote a letter. And I said, how can you take the show off the air? It's only 3 years into its five-year mission. I mean, I took it literally. You're going to have a five-year mission, damn it, and I want to see that. You know, I mean, it did – people got passionate about the program.
Was this the first time that a network had basically changed, had reneged on its plan to cancel a show?
I can't say for sure, but I'm pretty sure that it was.
And Bijo Trimble was a key part of that. She was a fan there in Southern California. Is Bijo still with us?
She's still around. I saw a picture of her. She's on Facebook. They went to the conference or the Comic-Con recently in San Diego.
Okay.
Yeah, so I saw a picture of her. I think she's got purple hair now.
Purple?
Yeah, she's still doing her thing out there. Yeah.
Well, she spearheaded this campaign, and I contributed. I used my show as a you know, back then, you know, this little Dewline show over on this little tiny 1,000-watt daytimer near Springfield, Massachusetts. And I used I had so many people of the cast because Gene would send them kind of through Spring. I don't know why they all came to Springfield. I got Leonard on my show. I got Bill on the show. Mm. I think I got DeForest Kelly.
Oh yeah, we haven't even talked about him.
No. George Takei. Well, DeForest was my favorite Star Trek star because he never was a star.
Yeah,
he was just a guy who was so lucky, and he knew he was lucky, and he saw it as a vehicle to explore that character in ways that I think went way beyond Gene's original idea.
Yeah, he was a great person too. I enjoyed just chatting with him. He was very down to earth, very low key, and just pleasant to be around. He was a lovely man. I liked him a lot. His character was important because it kept Captain Kirk grounded. As we were saying before, people that just tuned in, you know, the three of them together became kind of one entity: Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And McCoy was an important part of that, a very important part.
What's the story behind my favorite original episode, if you know it? If you don't, obviously, we can't talk about it. But
City on the Edge of Forever.
City on the Edge of Forever.
The story that I've heard and the one that Gene told was that the one that Harlan Ellison had written would have blown the entire budget for the whole year, that it was very, very elaborate and it was just unfilmable. And so He did some rewriting, and also there were some strange things in there. Like, at least Gene claimed this, and I have no way of verifying it, but he said things like Scotty was dealing drugs, and I don't know. There were all kinds of strange things.
On Harlan's original script, Harlan Ellison, if you don't know, was an enfant terrible science fiction writer who was more egocentric and narcissistic than Donald Trump. You can say that, right? Brilliant writer. Brilliant writer.
Yeah. I don't know if he's more egotistical. He was pretty self-confident, I would say.
Anyway, I had shall we say, I knew Harlan before you knew Harlan. How's that?
I am sure you did. I've only crossed paths with him a few times. And he's, I don't know if he's mellowed out with age or not, but yeah.
I'd love to get him on the show because, you know, he'd be a font of information. So anyway, so.
And he can give you his point of view on the city on the edge of forever.
Yeah, so he envisioned this huge, almost, you know, cyclopean, majestic episode. And all of that for television had to be cut down to characters saying, look over there, the ruins go on forever, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, there was only so much you could do with $186,000 a week. That was the cost, and I don't know, by the third season or the second season, it may have increased, but... and those are not in today's dollars, of course, but even back then that was considered pretty low budget, you know, so they reused things a lot and
oh yes, yes.
They would shine a red light on what they call the psych. It's a cyclorama, big screen or sheet that goes all the way around the soundstage, and they could shine a red light on it and you're on a planet where the sky glows red or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they changed that around a lot. They did a few location things. One of my favorites is the they used Vasquez Rocks, where the one with the Gorn.
Yes, yes, I know those. Every Western ever shot, every Lone Ranger, those rocks have appeared on screen in those ancient Western episodes.
Yeah,
and what about the one Shore Leave? Where
Shore
do they shoot
was
Shore
also
Leave?
A location somewhere. I'm not sure. Some garden or something in not Descanso Garden, but. But somewhere in the Los Angeles area, there were a few, and they did a location for the episode that I wrote, Ménage à Trois. That was in Next Generation. They did a lot more location work in that show. They had a better budget.
Mm.
The network didn't think they thought it was a kiddie show. They didn't think it was worth throwing money at it.
Well, wasn't Star Trek one of the only shows? I think maybe the only show, at least Gene told me, where he took it to CBS first.
Right.
And they said to him very archly, we already have a sci-fi show that was Lost in Space.
Oh! Exactly, yeah.
So then he picked up his marbles and went over to NBC, and right. They wanted a pilot, so he created what, a second pilot?
Well, he did the first pilot, and they said it was too cerebral.
Yeah.
That was the Cage. They wanted more shoot 'em ups, and, you know, he pitched it as a Western in space, or Wagon Train to the Stars.
Yep.
Wagon Train being a Western show at that time. And they said there
Bond.
Wasn't enough action in it, so they ordered an unprecedented second pilot episode. And it was a Desi Lu production. Desi Lu being Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball had a production company, and they seriously believed in this show. And so they went ahead. It wasn't Paramount at the time. They hadn't been bought out yet by Paramount. And so they commissioned it and produced it. And Lucy really believed in the show.
I was going to say, in recent years, more and more has come out that without Lucille Ball, Gene's mm-hmm. vision of Star Trek probably would never have seen the screen. Is that true?
Very possible. Extremely possible. And Desi Arnaz was a great businessman, from what I've read. Kind of like George Burns. I'm hoping we're going to get there.
We will get there. Don't worry.
But... So, as a team at the time, I don't think they were speaking to each other. They were divorced.
Oh, God.
But they were a partnership and a working partnership that worked really well. She was quite creative and not the airhead that she portrayed in I Love Lucy at all.
Not at all, no.
No.
So what did she see? Because, again, people are seriously arguing that without her attachment, her great persistence in following, you know, making it work, Gene's vision would never have gotten on the air.
I think Gene had a good influence on her. He told me that when they would you know, have a meeting or I don't know if they all got together or whatever, and they're standing around and having a cocktail or something, that she would come over and rub her leg on the inside of his leg, just take her foot and rub it up and down on his leg. And she kind of had – he was a very good-looking man. And
well, he was very manly. He was a big guy. He was what, 200 and some pounds, 225?
Yeah, well, that was at his very much too heaviest. But he was about 6'3", so he was pretty tall. And, you know, I think she had an attraction for him, and he probably sweet-talked her. I don't think they were sleeping together or anything like that. But I think that, you know, he was persuasive, and she was probably very interested in the show, or she wouldn't have backed it. But she really did help launch the show and doesn't get enough credit for it.
I would love someone to do a book, hint, hint, on her role, because everybody – Let me tell you a story that I don't know whether it's out of time. I don't know whether it makes any sense or not. Did you ever see the movie that she and Ricky did called The Long, Long Trailer?
Of course. Yeah. Okay. Back in the 50s. Right.
In the 50s. I remember seeing it at the drive-in because my parents would take poor kids, you know, we'd go to the drive-in. And I remember seeing that movie, and in the middle of it, I broke down crying. I must be, what, 9, 8, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And I could never, for years, I could not figure out why was I suddenly crying. And I was crying because I imagined that she and Desi were dead. Now, we're talking Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. They're in a comedy. I'm watching the comedy, and I'm breaking into tears. It took me decades, Susan, to figure out what that was all about.
And what was it about?
Her connection with Star Trek.
Oh.
The only reason I can think of is because at some level... And we're dealing with non-corporeal consciousness. You know, Gene is kind of smiling. He's giving me notes tonight. The connection between her and the fact that without her, Star Trek would not live, and without Star Trek, a whole several generations would not imagine a future that's so different from this one that we have to somehow get from here to there. In other words, her role in that show that would be so important in my life, I'm now looking back and I'm saying... There had to have been some connection, some resonance, some whatever that I fastened on that person and realized that she was pivotal in something that would so impact not only me but a whole bunch of other people that we would never know about. At least in hindsight, that's what I'm thinking.
Well, that's it. It's probably 20/20 hindsight, but who knows?
We don't have any other.
I don't know. But as a 9-year-old, you broke down crying. And you think that you were foreseeing this?
I don't know. There's no rational logic to it. But why would I break down crying about two characters? Everybody loved Lucy, you know, her TV show and all that. But watching that film, I suddenly imagined that she was no more. And that's what made me this incredible depression. And I now look back and I say, was there something? Because without her presence, Star Trek would not exist. And without Star Trek... You and I would not be having this conversation, and a whole bunch of you all over the world would not be following what we're talking about because they know everything about the series intimately. They know it's a projection of where we can go if we keep our act together. And all of that encompassed, at least I think there may have been a resonance because we've got all kinds of data now. The consciousness is not confined to this time or space. All those things that Gene played with on television – they're all out there. They're all real. At some level, they're real. Dean Radin, who's a scientist, works for the Noetic Science Institute up in Northern California. He's got data showing that before 9/11, hours before 9/11, the data shows that people consciously knew something awful was happening, and they anticipated it by hours and hours, out of time, precognition, something that Gene would be totally swept up in.
Yeah, maybe. He actually did some research for a script that he had to write, and it was very interesting. And you were talking earlier about somebody said something about the Council of Nine.
I'll tell you what, hang on there. Let's pick up on that when we come back. We're at the bottom of the hour. 1.5 hour left to go, and we have to get George Byrne and Gracie Allen into this conversation, and you're all going to wonder, how am I going to do that? Just stay tuned, and you'll find out. You're on the other side of midnight, and we are boldly going where someone, a very special someone, has gone before. We shall return. ¶¶ And we are back with the Star Trek theme from the original. Did you ever meet Alexander Courage?
No, I never did.
Oh.
I know he composed the theme music. Who did I meet? I'm trying to think. Some other composer, but I can't remember who it was.
Fred Steiner?
That was it, yeah. I met him in Santa Fe many years ago. I think he's passed away since then, but yeah.
Okay, someone is calling in, Darren, who you can always count on for a very interesting question, so we will include Darren in the conversation. Good morning. Welcome to The Other Side.
Hi, Barbara. So nice to talk to you.
It's actually Susan. Where did Barbara come from?
I don't know.
Do we know
I'm sorry.
A Barbara?
Susan.
That's okay.
Barbara. No, that's
I'll answer
really,
to anything.
That's a great start to the call.
As my dad used to say, you know, you can call me anything, just don't call me late for dinner.
Right. Sorry about that.
We got to figure out, is Barbara this gal you're meeting with quietly somewhere? I shouldn't do that to you.
Maybe it's a middle name of somebody else. Who knows?
Barbara.
What ideas did he bounce off you that you used in the show that we would know or recognize?
Okay. Well, I don't know. You know, people tune in at various times, so you probably might not have heard everything, but not so
well,
much.
Well, I know you wrote an episode. I heard that.
Right. I wrote a couple of episodes, but not so much that, but like in creating Next Generation, we changed it. I suggested changing it from where no man has gone before to where no one has gone before.
Right.
And I came up with the acronym for the thing that Geordi wears, the visor.
Oh, the visor.
And I created the name for that, and it stands for Visual Instrument and Sensory, V-I-S, Sensory Organ Replacement. It's been so long. Visual Instrument.
So what was the decision? There's your little girl.
No, that's not mine.
Oh, really?
It's mine.
It's yours.
My kids are getting back from Pokemoning.
Uh-oh.
Anyways.
So it was the visor that they didn't know what they just kept calling it the thing that Geordi wears. So I said, what about visor, visual instrument and sensory organ replacement?
Wow.
And, oh, cool.
So they bought that. And and in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock.
Yes.
And Harve Bennett always gave me credit for this. It was my idea that he be regenerated from the Genesis planet.
Oh, what an interesting idea. The physics would be there, and of course he would come
obvious.
Back.
Obvious.
Obvious, yes.
And they're all going, oh, that's great. You know, and Harve would give credit to me for that idea. Never got any money, but I got credit.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So those are my big contributions, I guess.
So Spock might not be here.
Spock
movies.
Was going to, you know, the search for Spock. They found him.
what do you think
of
the fan
movie.
Series? Do you like the fan series?
You know, I was on a judging panel, not this year, but the year before, for the Trek Track in Atlanta, which is part of, or it's a spinoff from Dragon Con. It used to be part of Dragon Con. And I was... subjected to or I saw, let me put it that way, 17 different fan films, some of which were terrific, some which were not so great, and I can't remember the names of the winners right now, but it was a lot of fun watching them. You mentioned
I think
Vic,
so too.
Yeah, you mentioned Vic, I can't remember his last name, but he
Mignogna.
Yeah, he played in a couple of them. He was really good. And
such a personification of Shatner.
Yeah, no, he's really good, and I enjoyed watching those.
They've gotten better. Sick.
And, you know, I think it's terrible that Paramount is cracking down on people that are, or CBS or whatever, that are trying to do this, because it's you know, expression. It's freedom of expression, and people are having fun with it. They're not making piles of money off of
it. It's so short-sighted, because if you want a buzz, if you're launching a series or continuing a series, you want a buzz. And now with social media, the best way is to have, in other words, role models.
Yeah, I think it's terrific that people are being creative and coming up with things. I mean, they've been writing fanzines for years.
Exactly.
It's just the personification of that. So I don't see
anything. Yeah, it's like they have the Ten Commandments now where – they can only use so much money, or $50,000, or something like that. Or
Ten Commandments. I thought you were going to say they can only afford five or something.
No. Well, they just don't want them to be very good. They're worried they're going to get really good, probably. I don't know.
Okay, anything else, Darren?
No, thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you, Darren.
Okay. Nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Okay, our number, 505-796-8802, and on Skype, Enterprise Mission, or The Other Side of Midnight. Where did this association of Gene with the Council of Nine come from?
Well, I don't know that it was ever called the Council of Nine. They were just called the Nine. And then he was approached by a man named John Whitmore. I think he was a sir, who was very wealthy. And he had this money, and he wanted to do a film. And he hired Gene, who was not doing anything at the time. This was like 1974, 75. He hired him to write a script about various psi phenomena. And Gene said, well, I'll do it if I can do the research. And so he got to meet a whole lot of people, some of whom are charlatans, some of whom he was not able to, he did meet with some interesting people that I can't recall who they were at the time. And so he wrote this script for hire. And I think that he then asked John Povill years later, and John lives in Vancouver now. He asked John to handle the project for him. And then I think John was working on it not too long ago. I don't know if they were putting it together or not, but
Does he have the script?
John?
Yeah.
Yeah, he probably does.
That would be interesting.
You might enjoy talking with him sometime too.
Yes, yes. Well, when we get off the show, we can exchange numbers and all that. But
yeah, I don't have his number, but he's on Facebook, and he was associate producer on the first film, and he was working with Gene when I met Gene, doing chores around the house, and then he became a writer, and he worked on Sliders, the show Sliders. I think he wrote a couple episodes of that. I don't know. I haven't.
You did something for Sliders.
Did Total Recall. Yeah, I wrote a story for it. But John did. He was involved with Total Recall, the first movie, and the rewrite too. The second. You remember Total Recall?
Yeah, of
with
course.
Schwarzenegger.
I was told by a friend of mine, very high up at Fox, that Total Recall was basically taken not only from the famous book by, I can't remember the name of the guy, but also from Monuments. That they actually cribbed the Martian stuff from Monuments. Remember how they say in that scene where he's eavesdropping, it's a 500,000 years old, et cetera, et cetera? So I was told they basically stole it from my own book on Mars. So.
Oh, okay.
Who knows?
I don't know. I think it came from a Philip K. Dick story.
That was the main plot, but the subplot, they say they stole this Fox person, this person who was in a position to know, told me they took it from Monuments. So.
Okay. Well, anyway, so John was involved with that, and he was going to do the Nine. It was called The Nine, and I don't recall what that was about.
Well, so I have to get hold of him to find out more about The Nine.
Probably, yeah.
Okay. By the way, let me tell people, if they want to call, you got about 20 minutes left, 505-796-8802. I don't know when we're going to be able to get Susan back. She has a very busy schedule, and there's all kinds of stuff going on in this 50th anniversary year, so we're very lucky. So if you want to talk to her, you can slide in now. Let's talk about what happened to you after Star Trek, because we can't go through all of Star Trek, and I know you got some very interesting writing, and you wrote about two people that in Hollywood are two of my favorite people, and I want to know how we get from here to there. Because when Star Trek kind of faded into the great Western sunset, you had these writing background now. You were a writer.
Yeah.
What did you do with that talent?
Well, I don't know if it's talent. They say it's like 10% talent and 90% sweat, but any kind of endeavor like that creatively.
And 100% rewriting.
Oh, yeah. Rewrite. And while I was working with Gene, I was working on several different books and projects, and he was very – uh-oh, did I just get disconnected?
No, you're right here.
Oh.
No, I just added someone else. We're going to hold them kind of in the wings until you finish your point here.
Okay. So, while I was working, he was very understanding, and he encouraged me to write, and I wrote books about the TV industry. I wrote a book about Hollywood Sings, which was about all the songs that were ever nominated for Academy Awards, and primetime hits, all the shows that were number one on TV, and so on and so forth through the 80s.
I know what happened to you.
What happened?
It's so obvious now.
What?
You got bitten by the Asimov bug.
Oh, really?
You have 12 published books to your credit.
Yeah, I have a lot of books.
I only have two or three.
And they're all, what? They're all about TV. Well, three of them are about Star Trek. The fourth one about Star Trek never got published because Leonard Nimoy never signed off on his photos that were going to be published in it. That was the 25th anniversary book. Oh. So that was 25 years ago. And it was the 25th anniversary. So now it's twice as long as that, which is weird. And then I somehow picked up an agent along the way, and he said to me, do you want typing practice or do you want to write something that's going to sell? Said, yeah, okay, give me an idea. And he said, well, how about a book about Burns and Allen? And, you know, I wasn't really an expert on them. I had watched the show when I was a kid. So this was back in the 80s, so 86, I think, the first book came out. And it's the story of George Burns and Gracie Allen with emphasis on their television show because that's my interest, television.
Right.
And so I wrote this with my partner, Cheryl
Blight. Okay, so if we go to Radio with Pictures, number four, Say Goodnight, Gracie. It's right. The cover for your book on George Burns and Gracie Allen.
Right, and it's we've just brought it out as an ebook. It's out of print as a paperback. You can pick up used copies, of course, but it's now an ebook on Amazon, and we've added quite a bit to it. We updated it. We've talked about, you know, who's passed and who's still around. Pretty much not anybody, but and you know how they met, when they met, how they got together, how they ended up working in vaudeville. Their movie career. People, you know, think of George Burns as God, but
with a cigar,
But he had a whole career with Gracie before.
Oh, those old films are so priceless. Getty TV and some others are running them at weird hours, you know, like at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is when I get off here. It's amazing to see the interaction. And again, like Lucy, Gracie was not a dumb blonde.
No, not at all. That was just the part she played. Actually, her hair was quite dark, and she lightened it for TV. But we talk about that, too. She was quite intelligent. She started out as a dancer when she was very, very young. She was like 4 years old. Her parents pushed her out on the stage. And so she was a dancer. She was this Irish Colleen, and she sang and danced. And she went to New York to try to find her career, and it wasn't happening. And so she was going to secretarial school. At the time, women could be stenographers, they called them. And her roommate said, there's this act I'd like to go see in New Jersey. Let's go watch this guy. His name is I don't even think he was performing under the name George Burns at that time. He might have been. He kept changing his name. He didn't care. He wanted to be in show business. If somebody had a card that said Eddie Delight is appearing tonight, he would, and Eddie didn't show up, he would say, I'm Eddie Delight. He'd, you know, show up on the stage. We talk about this. It's so much fun in the book where if somebody was looking for a dog act in vaudeville and they couldn't find one, he went out, he'd round up stray dogs, bring them on the stage and say, hey, I've got a dog act, you know, and they'd put them on. And he didn't care what the dogs were doing. He was tap dancing and singing. He just wanted to be on the stage. Dogs are running around sniffing each other. And he's up there, you know, dancing his heart out. And so we talk about their early days in vaudeville and film. And then when they finally got their TV series, we really go into depth on that and talk about that. We have synopses of every episode that was ever filmed, and they're all on YouTube.
All these TV series, these variety show or quasi comedies, were basically derivatives of the radio era when they were all a network radio.
Right, and they did a lot of radio. They had their own radio show for years, and they would have guests come on, and they did all kinds of routines and whatnot, and they had an announcer.
Don Pardo.
It wasn't Don Pardo.
No, it wasn't.
It was Bill Goodwin, and then after him, it was Harry Von Zell.
Never argue with a gal who's written a book. Okay.
And they would do commercials in the middle of the show. They'd stop and Harry would talk about carnation milk. And then, oh, yes, Gracie would say, I loved carnation milk and I use it in my coffee all the time and blah, blah, blah. And they had to do the commercials too. it's a lot of fun. And we'd talk about how she hated the idea of the television camera. She was a performer and she would get into a role and she did not want to see a camera with a red light shining at her, and she didn't want it, so they had to turn the light off. That was the camera that would be taking, you know, it was a three camera show, which was very innovative for
that. And it was live, there was no tape.
It wasn't really live, they filmed it. And George saw the potential in reruns.
So they filmed it on 60 millimeter film.
And well, first they did kinescopes. They filmed it off of the TV screen, and it was live the first year. I think it was from New York. And but then they began to film it with three cameras so they could get all the angles. And this is done with live comedy today, too. They could get all the angles, so they have three cameras, and then they edit it later. And they would show it. They didn't want to have the canned laughter that a lot of sitcoms have. So they would show it to a live audience to get their reaction. And they would record their, you know, oh, look out, watch out, you know, and all the things people say in the audience. And they would then put that in the track. So there was a lot of innovation going on, especially the part about reruns. And George was a fantastic producer. He had his own production company, and they produced a whole lot of shows that people probably today never heard of, like The People's Choice with Jackie Cooper and Cleo the Talking Dog, Mr. Ed.
They
did Mr. Ed. That was part of the McFadden Productions. Was it McFadden? Yeah.
So they were a talented team like Lucy and Desi.
That was mostly George doing that. Gracie retired. She was sick of showbiz. And every year George would come to her and say, oh, guess what? They renewed our contract. And she'd go, yay. She did not want to perform anymore. She wanted to be home playing with her grandchildren. And eventually she did get to do that. And she had a heart condition. And so, you know, to her, it was time to just rest and relax. And she died quite young. I think she was 64 years old, maybe something like that. And so George went on to he had to be in show business. He had to work. It's what he wanted to do.
Well, it obviously kept him alive. It kept him so young. He was over 100.
Yeah, he died exactly. He said he was going to live to be 100 because he was booked.
That's great.
He was supposed to play the Palladium on his 100th birthday. Unfortunately, he slipped in the bathtub and his head.
Sent me a note. Caller, you've been waiting there very patiently. Susan and I are trying to catch up here in 2 hours. Sign in, please.
Well, you brought back so many memories. I want to talk about how Star Trek changed my life forever.
Okay, who are you first?
Give your first name. I am Bill, and I am in North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
You've probably seen some emails from me previously a long time ago. Anyway, thank you so much for the show. I'd like to talk about, I was a Boy Scout, 12 years old, and came back from our Boy Scout meeting. I was on a Wednesday night. I believe this was 1968, either 68 or 69. And we had a I didn't know this until I got home. I walked into the den and expecting to see the Mitch Miller show. However, it had been preempted by Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And WGHP Channel 8, which was ABC affiliate back then, was a black and white broadcasting show. They didn't have color. And the reception was kind of fuzzy. So here I am expecting to see, you know, this happy Mitch Miller nonsense. And it was a good show. A lot of people liked it, but it wasn't me. But I see Spock sitting in the bridge chair and fuzzy reception, and at that moment, I could have sworn that the aliens had taken over the world.
Television.
And they were trying to talk to us through the Channel 8.
Oh, my.
And it was just, it was a lot, you know, and then after that, I was hooked and been hooked all my life on Star Trek.
Wow. You know, that's one heck of an introduction.
I had a similar experience when I first saw Star Trek. I missed it the first week. I caught it the second week, and I they were sitting around on the bridge, and there's Spock with the pointed ears, and it's like nobody's saying anything. I'm thinking, don't they notice that this guy's got pointed ears? Why aren't they saying anything? Look, there's a guy with pointed ears. Don't you see him? And
it's like, that might have been the same episode. And, you know, talking about the triumvirate of, you know, the trifold mind of the three characters, I always thought I was Shatner. But I always wanted to be Spock.
Of course.
But I think there's a little bit of McCoy in all of us, too. Yeah. So it's kind of like the Three Stooges. All wrapped up in the
and, now, that's a comparison I have never heard.
I've never heard.
Or like Gandhi, Clint, and Curly. That sort of.
Okay.
But and I'll leave you with this, because you're talking about Lucille Ball and being affected when you're 9 years old and having this realization that she was part of it all and of a lot of things. Well, when I moved to Southern California for the first time, this had been late 76, 77, I was at the Market Basket. I don't know if they're still around anymore. There's a huge grocery store. Matter of fact, on the Beverly Hillbillies, Granny goes to this Market Basket that I went into and saw how big the tomatoes was and almost had a heart attack. So I'm just excited that I'm in the Market Basket where they film that episode. As I'm walking out, there's a little old lady all in black with this huge onload of bags, grocery bags. And, you know, being a good Boy Scout, of course, I ran across the parking lot and helped put the stuff into her limousine. And it was Lucy.
You're kidding.
And wow. This is, she must have been 80, maybe in her 80s at this point. And I recognized her immediately. And I'm just, you know, oh, my God, here I am. I'm in L.A. now.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. Okay, we only have 5 minutes left, and I got to do a couple things here.
Okay,
so
you guys go for it, really. I really support your show. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Bye-bye.
There's a million stories in the Naked City, and we don't have time for all of them tonight. In fact, almost no more. Let me tell you a couple of things I wanted to bring up, and obviously we'll have to do this when you come back.
Okay.
I want the story of how Whoopi Goldberg basically wanted to be a Next Generation. That's a story that I think is so important for a whole bunch of reasons. So think about that, and we'll talk about that the next time, because I know there's an amazing story there. The other thing I want to tell you is that there are two technologies that we're going to be talking about in the next few weeks on this show, which are directly derivative of the kind of technologies that Gene talked about but never imagined almost in his lifetime would come to pass. One of them is the foundation for, in essence, impulse drive, leading to warp drive. And the other is the basis of what's someday going to be the replicator, the ability to maneuver the ether to basically make matter out of nothing with just a template. And, of course, it was the replicator and these technologies that allowed a future that Gene envisioned where we wouldn't be worried about money. People would go to work at things they were good at, not things they had to do, etc. In other words, the linchpin, the underpinnings of the whole Star Trek mythos as Gene envisioned it, are these technologies that free us, and those technologies have now been invented and fostered by people behind this show, the audience, and we're going to debut them in the next few weeks and show people what they will be able to do to change the world so it does eventually come out like Star Trek.
Good.
And I'd like to invite you to be part of that when we do that.
Okay. Are you going to be on at midnight?
No, we'll probably have moved by then, so we'll be in a slightly more, conducive time. But we're almost out of time here. What are you doing these days?
Well, I'm very active with the humanist movement, as I mentioned briefly earlier. I'm on the board of directors, and it's strictly voluntary. It's not a paid position. the American Humanist Association, which is headquartered in Washington, AHA, and I'm also on the International Humanist and Ethical Union's Board of Directors, and I get to travel a lot, which is kind of fun. I just got back from San Francisco, but I spent a lot of time in London. I was in Malta this year. I've been to Belgium and Amsterdam, and last year we went to the Philippines. And so I get to do a bit of travel, and it's a worthy cause. I'm a very, very happy humanist, as they say.
Who would not have become a humanist if it weren't for Gene? Who wouldn't have become a humanist if it weren't for Isaac? And I keep calling him Isaac because, you know, Isaac Asimov used to say he was my surrogate father. That's a whole other story. Well, this has been incredible. It's been too short. 2 hours is much too short. So we must do this again. It is the 50th anniversary year. And since I have a show, I can do anything I want. I will have you back. And we'll talk about some amazing things and show you some amazing things that really, I wish Gene was here to enjoy it. So until tomorrow morning, same time, same bat channel. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.